want that is the kicky music that brings you back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And today on the show, it is our second to last show of 2011.
Our penultimate
episode. We missed the opportunity to point out our anti-penultimate episode.
Yes.
It is not actually our penultimate episode, because it is not our next-to-last episode ever.
That's true, but of 2011.
Of
at any rate, this incredibly...
No, I'd like to discuss this.
It's already just off the rails.
This incredibly exciting conversation is by way of letting you know that you might expect our predictions for 2012 to come in our very last episode of 2011, but we decided that we want to have our next episode be our best of 2011 so that we have as much time as possible to take things in before we start trying to decide what our favorite things of the year were. That means, in a roundabout, origami paper folding kind of way, that this week we are going to talk about pop culture predictions for 2012. We are also, because it's what we do here, going to talk about what is making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's introduce everybody around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
And I do at least one of those things for the movie section.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Stephen Thompson, start me off with a prediction for 2012.
I tried to stick somewhat in my wheelhouse. Sure. I did not want to, for example, focus on a prediction related to German art song, thus stealing Trey Graham's
thunder. So you're keeping those to yourself.
I'm keeping those to myself. I have them. I have many German art songs.
They're in your diary.
They're in my dream journal.
Mm.
So I decided to stick somewhat in my little music-y wheelhouse as a prediction. Spotify. Now, this has already happened. This is not actually a prediction.
I was going to say, if you're going to predict the rise of Spotify...
I'm going to say...
I have news for you.
There's going to be...
These are supposed to be for 2012, not 2011. Anyone
can predict the future.
Right.
But I have a spotless record of predicting the present.
There you go. Mm.
All right. Anyway, I think that Spotify certainly is going to continue to sort of further dominate the way that people listen to music and trade music and discuss music. But I think that ultimately at some point in 2012, it will be derailed by a service that benefits musicians even less than Spotify does. What I'm envisioning is a service that gives you a band's album for free, and then if you don't like it, you can hit them with pots.
You're allowed to charge them.
Right. So we'll find some way to actually take from artists more than merely their art.
I see. Hmm. So you're predicting spite for 2012.
You know, that is so my way.
That's great.
Fingers crossed.
That is wonderful. Trey Graham,
I'm not going to give you a broad, long-range, far-in-the-future prediction. I'm going to give you an early 2012 prediction, although I hope that it's one that you all will not have seen coming but will agree with. Seth Rogen, Oscar nominee.
Really?
Yes.
For
what?
For co-writing the movie 50-50. This is the cancer comedy with
the
Jason.
Cancer-mity.
Those are two K's, exactly. By the way. Exactly. Cancer comedy.
Cancer comedy.
Yeah.
Starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Rogen, who actually did a fairly solid job of acting. I'm not going to go out so far on a limb as to suggest that he will get an acting nomination, but the writers, I suspect, are going to rally behind his co-writer, whose name is Will Reiser, and the story is based on Reiser's own battle with cancer, successful battle.
That's a very interesting prediction.
I think that Reiser is going to be on the short list, and that means that Rogen is going to be on the short list.
So you have a sentimental favorite and an unsentimental non-favorite, and you are proposing favorite will drag up.
I'm also saying that Hollywood likes to do this kind of thing.
Absolutely.
From time to time, you know, to confer seriousness on somebody who's actually done a solid job.
It's just going to be another incredibly important thing that Seth Rogen and Ben Affleck will have in common.
That's right, yeah. So, yes, Seth Rogen, Oscar nominee.
Actually, since you said Oscar nominee, I will go to one of mine, because I also have an Oscar nominee. And I am going to say Melissa McCarthy for Bridesmaids, Best Supporting Actress. Doesn't happen very often. The comedy player in a large ensemble comedy, very, very unusual to be singled out of an ensemble like that in like an Apatow type.
Right,
movie.
Right.
Sure. And when it does happen, it's more an ingenue part. It's more a My Cousin Vinny or a Mighty Aphrodite kind of thing.
Very, very true. Not only did she win an Emmy, so she's kind of got this momentum going in general. And she's so likable, and she hasn't made any mistakes in terms of how she presents herself in public. But I think people have sort of realized how many dimensions of fearlessness are contained in that performance. Not only is it just weird, which is always fearless. Mm-hmm. And my favorite story about that is that she based that character on Guy Fieri from the Food Network, just in terms of having the big, loud personality mm-hmm. and this kind of weird, kind of spiky oddness of yeah. Guy Fieri. But, you know, for an actress who was at the time that this movie was made, one of maybe, you know, two or three plus-size actresses getting work mm-hmm. at all in Hollywood, although not then like she does now, to take an opportunity like this, when one of the advantages that you have as Melissa McCarthy is that you are incredibly pretty.
Right. You can pretty yourself up and play the...
That's mm-hmm. part of what has helped her overcome that...
Right.
Prejudice and difficulty
right.
is that she's gorgeous. So she takes this part that's kind of the biggest profile thing she's done at that
mm-hmm.
time
right.
and plays it as a very kind of desexualized,
right.
really aggressive, androgynous
and in several
type of,
scenes actively unattractive.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. And manages nevertheless to kind of pull that off in a way that maintains an air of coolness and, mm-hmm. you know, specialness. And she's able to go back to her sitcom where it's much more of a traditional romantic part. So she did a lot of really cool things in that movie and a lot of things that I really admire a lot. But the reason she's going to get the nomination is that she's so, so funny.
Right.
She jumps off the screen in this movie that has all these other people in it, all of whom are good and all of whom are funny. And there's a bunch of really good stuff in that movie. But that scene over and over, you'll hear people talk over and over about the scene where she introduces herself and tells a story about being on a cruise ship and falling off, hitting all the railings on the way. It's the weirdest, coolest entrance for a character, and I think she's going to wind up with an Oscar nomination.
I wholeheartedly support that idea.
Yeah, I think she's enormously beloved by the awards-giving community, having already won big at the Emmys, mm-hmm. and I think this is, you know, step two on her path toward the EGOT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she's gotten a little bit of recognition from some of the local critics boards. The Washington area film critics mm-hmm. recognized her among their actors as well. That ensemble is getting a surprising little bump of showing up on some of these end-of-year critics lists and award lists, which doesn't always happen with that kind of ensemble comedy. So that's my prediction. Glenn Weldon, give me a prediction for 2012.
Okay, I predict, and this is going to sound a little esoteric, I predict there's going to be a major change in the landscape of comedy podcasts. And not the one that many people are predicting. Many people are saying there is right now objectively a boom in comedy podcasts.
Absolutely.
Many people are calling it a glut.
Bordering on glut.
Right.
Yeah.
Many people are saying that we're about to enter a sort of a bust phase. I don't think that's going to happen. In fact, I think we're going to get more and more comedy podcasts, and I think that's inevitable. I also happen to think, for reasons I'll get into in a second, that that's a good thing. One of the reasons that we're having a boom right now is because of the L.A. comedy scene has a infrastructure around it. There are four ersatz networks that produce many different shows. These are Nerdist, Earwolf, A Special Thing, and Maximum Fun. So these work as sort of networks in that all the shows that are put out by those networks kind of cross-promote each other in a way. There are certainly comedians out there who say, I don't want to do a podcast. Why should I give away my act for
uh-huh.
free?
Uh-huh.
And a lot of this is that I'm going to be saying now is pretty obvious to a lot of people who've done any thinking about social media. But here's why I think that this comedy podcast boom isn't going away. There is no disadvantage to putting out a podcast if you're a comedian. They are low cost. It's not like we're talking about the comedy bust of the 80s when all the chuckle huts Mirth Shacks around the country just sort of closed up. It gives you an access to new audiences. I am a comedy nerd. I have bought more comedy albums this year than any year previous.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm also not going to comedy clubs like I used to mm-hmm. because I'm a 43-year-old gay dude and I don't want to spend an evening with a bunch of drunk, fratty tourist D-bags if I can avoid it in a comedy club setting. Outside of this room.
It really ruins my Christmas gift for you.
I try to minimize that as much as this room. And so, if a comedian is saying, I don't care about how many albums I sell. I get my money from touring, and the reason I want to do a podcast is to get people to come and see me. If your audience is in the 20 to 30s, they might go out to see you. I have a very nice apartment. I'm not going out to see you. And I'm getting your comedy but I'm not getting your act. I'm getting your persona. I'm getting your, to be really annoying about it, I'm getting your brand. And I'm also hearing from a lot more comedians than I ever have. The fact that there are so many isn't really that big a deal because humor is subjective. The idea is that you can listen to as many as you want to pick and choose the ones you like. So having this many, I don't think the economics of it work in the same way that the comedy bust and boom of the 80s happened. The main thing, though, that I see happening, this is my actual prediction, is that the infrastructure that the LA comedy scene has, which is, again, it's a bunch of LA comedians mm-hmm. talking to other LA comedians about comedy in LA.
Right.
I think this is going to happen in New York. It's going to happen in Chicago, other comedy towns. It just mm-hmm. makes sense. There are already plenty of great New York-based comedy podcasts. There's Julie Klausner's How Was Your Week? There's The Complete Guide to Everything. There's Mike and Tom Eat Snacks. You Had to Be There, Keith and the Girl. But what they lack is that infrastructure.
Right.
So there's no reason in the world why it wouldn't happen.
There wouldn't be a network around.
There wouldn't be a network mm-hmm. in New York. Mm-hmm. There wouldn't be a network in Chicago, another comedy mm-hmm. town. There might be something in L.A. about the culture. There might be this sort of lotus eating. They have more time because all their scripts are in turnaround and they're waiting to get a call back from the Hyundai ad. And they're just sitting around and they can... And maybe they're more, you know, convivial. Maybe they're more... there's more bonhomie in the LA comedy scene and it's more competitive in the New York scene. I don't know, but I think this is an inevitable development and I think it's a good one.
There's a lot of love within that New York scene.
Yeah.
I do have two follow-up questions for you about comedy and sort of prediction related. One is, can the comedians stay at your house when they come through town as some way of for you to pay them for your enjoyment of their art?
It depends on the comedian.
Okay. comedians are an unsavory lot.
Yeah.
The other is what do you think of, I'm sure you know about Louis C.K. selling a stand-up special online
mm-hmm.
for $5.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That he's reaching out to his fans and saying, give me $5 and you will have this completely original set of my act. Do you think there's a future in that? Do you think there's money in that? Prediction-wise, how do you see that developing?
Well, let me go back to the podcast. Jimmy Pardo was just on, I think it was the Nerdist podcast recently, talking about how his model for comedy podcasts, which is to get people to pay for the full podcast, couldn't have happened if he had done it any later when mm-hmm. the glut arrived, when mm-hmm. the boom arrived.
Right.
And he feels that he got in there at exactly the right time. He also said that his audience was booming up until he started charging, and then it plateaued.
Mm-hmm.
But those people are his core audience, and they're paying. So I don't know how to monetize the branding.
Can you monetize the brand of Louis C.K.?
But I think this is a time of incredible experimentation when people are going to be trying to figure out a way to make this thing work. I see that since there's no overhead, I don't see a downside. I don't see why you would not do this.
Right.
Maybe, now that I think of that, if you're a young comedian starting out and you haven't found your voice, it could theoretically, now that I'm thinking about it, it could be pretty lethal to put something out there that's not ready for prime time.
Right.
But people have short memories for that stuff, though.
You think so?
Sometimes. I mean, if there's such a gigantic glut, you put out something super flawed, people may forget about it, especially if you take it off iTunes.
Yeah. Very true. Mm. I like it. And I think that Louis C.K. model is worth watching. I think it'll be interesting to see how much folks like that wind up selling things to their core audience for $5 mm-hmm. instead of trying to make a DVD that costs $20 and figure out how to get people to... order it on Amazon and stuff like that. Are you just better off dealing with the people who absolutely love you and will pick up whatever you do? Or, in addition to selling the DVD, necessarily put it on cable and try to make your money through airings on cable, which sometimes stretch out for years, which I think in some ways that's what really kills material for everybody is if it's circulating on cable all the time. If you sold it to your core audience for $5, you can still go out and try to get new people, whereas if it's been circulating on Showtime for a year and a half mm-hmm. in heavy rotation on HBO or Showtime, then...
Well, that's the difference between a special and a podcast, because, again, with a special, you burn off your material.
Right.
And this is what happened in the 90s when there was just so many stand-up specials over and over again. You just saw these same people. You saw the jokes over and over again. What you're selling with a podcast is, again, it's the personality.
Right.
And you either want to hang with this person and you're interested in their act or you're not.
Right.
And this is it's just a great way to shop around.
Right. Excellent. Completely agree. Yeah. Speaking of completely agree, Stephen Thompson, give me a prediction for 2012.
All right. Well, I got a few little sort of music-related quick hits as mm-hmm. I was thinking about what are going to be the stories of music in 2012. Mm-hmm. One, I think it's clear that Adele is going to sweep the Grammys, mm-hmm. though because they have already given her Best New Artist, they're going to have to give that to Metallica.
Nice.
I was recently asked to talk about, on All Songs Considered, about what was the prevailing trend of the year. Mm-hmm. And I talked briefly about the appropriation of sort of maligned phenomena. So like the return of 80s influences
right.
in like, for example, the Bon Iver record,
that,
you know, where it's got this sort of Bruce Hornsby song on it.
Right.
You know, the way that bands
Speaking
like,
of Best New Artist, Bon Iver.
Yes, that's right. Best New Artist nominee Bon Iver. You know, bands that incorporate things like the saxophone and the ukulele, you know, where
right,
popping up
right.
and popping up on.
Ukulele is everywhere.
Ukulele
can't
is
get away from the ukulele.
All over the damn
the
place.
Truth.
So I was trying to think of something new and similarly maligned
sure.
That could be incorporated. I offer up LFO's song Summer Girls.
Okay.
So I think that some enterprising musician will find a way to repurpose Summer Girls. That's
wow.
The I love girls who wear Abercrombie and Fitch. Chinese food makes me sick.
I really sold that, Stephen.
Yeah. Invested in that lyric.
You sold it with a lot of enthusiasm.
I mean, this is an ongoing concern, but mm-hmm. the return of these long dormant figures. I mean, you know, one thing that we've talked about, not we on this podcast, but that's been talked about in general is sort of the return of Jeff Mangum and Neutral Milk Hotel. Mm-hmm. You know, you're already seeing reports of Afghan Whigs coming back. Dirty Three, which is one of my favorite bands of all time, has a record coming out first in 7 years, coming in February. Sinead O'Connor is attempting a comeback. I think you're going to see more of that. And finally, Dr. Dre. Album Detox finally going to come out, and it's going to be the most beloved long-awaited album since Chinese Democracy.
I hear ya. I know what you're saying. I gotcha.
Trey, I have no idea what that joke was about.
Trey Graham, give me a prediction for 2012.
Right, I'm going to give you a series of small quick hits, yes.
Sure.
The television writer Jane Espenson will take on a new project of some sort.
Yes. that is a great and fair and excellent
Don't
prediction.
You think? Yeah. She's got to be the
Husbands,
hardest.
Have you watched Husbands,
by the way? I have watched Husbands. It's kind of fun.
It's
silly. Web series.
Jane Espenson.
HusbandsTheSeries.com.
HusbandsTheSeries.com. Yeah.
Jane Espenson, for those of you who do not remember her name, she was a writer on Buffy. She was a writer on Battlestar Galactica. She's a consulting producer and writer on
Once Upon a Time,
which is currently on ABC, and she's got this web series, and that's not even half of what her credits.
She used to do
the hardest working woman in show business.
Yeah.
She's also just an all-around genius.
She used to have a blog about writing that mm-hmm. I really, really love that she doesn't keep up anymore, but she used to write about writing.
Yep.
And
well, that was her field. She studied cognitive linguistics.
She's just a really super interesting person to follow and to listen to, and she trades tweets with lots of interesting people.
So. Yes. I think just in general terms, I don't want to go into too many specifics, but in general terms, I think it's going to be a big year, 2012, for women directors in Hollywood. I think look at the landscape of projects that are coming out. You're gonna find out about some women who have been directing in TV, who maybe are making a movie mm-hmm. career now or making a move into movies. And some women that you just haven't heard about are going to have high-profile projects in 2012. So,
Women!
Ladies!
Going to be the year of the woman!
Didn't we already have a year of the woman?
Kind of did, yeah.
Every year
I feel like women are
year,
so 1984.
Yeah.
I also would like to predict that the Green Bay Packers are going to go to the Super Bowl and possibly win it. Mm. And finally, I would like to predict that the world will not end.
That's excellent.
Oh, yes. That is an excellent.
So you are going on a limb.
Going right out on a limb there.
That is bold.
If only the Green Bay Packers winning the Super Bowl were as inevitable as that.
Mm. All right. Well, I am going to predict boldly that they will not kill Community in 2012. They have put Community on hiatus until sometime in the spring. It was largely reported as sort of like, well, there goes that show. It is definitely a low-rated show. It is definitely a show that could die. It is beginning to be a show where the staff and cast are doing a lot of sort of apocalyptic tweeting in which they are coming closer and closer to telling NBC to take a long walk off a short
really
plank,
kind of
which
are.
I am not 100% sure is a great idea. But my broader prediction is they're going to have to figure out something to do at NBC besides what they're doing. Because what they're doing is they just keep throwing stuff up there and nobody likes any of it. And it's like at some point you either have to decide that you're going to become a cable network and just make super cheap stuff and expect super small audiences, or you have to figure out something else.
And that's just not their ambition at all. I mean, they continue to go big with sports and are constantly trying to...
Right. Correct. And so I think that they right now have so few options. And in fact, unfortunately, the other night, Parks and Recreation also hit sort of an all-time low rating, despite also being an excellent show. So the problem is they have sort of holes everywhere. And there's only so much that you can add when the closest you've come to a success this year. I mean, Up All Night is a show they've done that is a good show. But it's, you know, stumbling along, sort of. Whitney is a terrible show that is stumbling along, sort of. You know, they're not going to air Seinfeld reruns. They're not going to air Friends. Right. Like, there's only so much hole filling that you can do. And although they could certainly continue to try to fill holes and try to make new shows, and maybe they'll kill it. Maybe I'm wrong. But I feel like they're not out of that position yet that they've been in for the last 3 or 4 years, where things like Chuck and Friday Night Lights and Community and Parks and Rec, stuff that would have died on any other network, goes on because the least you can do is keep stuff that people admire.
Right.
Because Community is at least something that has a cult following. And the last thing NBC needs to do, it seems to me right now, is make everyone angry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe I'm wrong, and I'm not terribly confident in this prediction, but I just don't understand what they would do next fall by canceling a show like that. When they got their new executive, he came in and sort of said, look, you know, it's going to take time. It's not going to happen right away. And I'm not confident that meant, you know, everything that's underperforming that people love is going to get canceled within the next, you know, 12 months. So we'll just have to see. I am hopeful and I am predicting that it lives another year.
Within 48 hours of its hiatus being announced, it won the TV Guide Reader's Choice poll or something like that. Does that mean anything?
What it means is that show, like Chuck, like a lot of these other ones, still has the ability to muster enthusiasm.
I feel like NBC only has shows that appeal to angry cultists.
That is in short supply right now.
Yeah.
The ability to muster enthusiasm. They don't have a lot of things that muster a lot of enthusiasm. Even if you look at a show like The Office, which is watched by more people than Community, I don't think The Office could muster that kind of enthusiasm right now. You need people who are passionate about things. I mean, if you're thinking long term as a network, you have to keep an identity that people don't completely hate you. So that's sort of my hope for them. And also, of course, that if they keep it alive longer, you can put it in syndication and there's a whole business going on there about...
Well,
about
they move a lot of DVDs of that show, too.
They've just put the whole series on Hulu Plus. Mm-hmm. They're trying to sort of build interest in the back catalog, essentially. And the hope is they will keep it around long enough to boot it into syndication. So
yeah.
So that's my bold prediction.
Well, I think if nothing else, they should give that Jay Leno fellow a try in time.
Yeah, seriously, that turned out to be a great idea. Glenn Weldon. Prediction for 2012.
Criswell predicts. Do you guys know from Criswell?
Oh, yes.
Okay. He's the guy who introduces the narrator of Plan 9 from Outer Space, and he introduces the film by saying something like, you are interested in events that will happen in the future because that is where you and I will spend most of our time. And then he says, remember, these future events will happen to us all in the future. So I'm going to predict that there are three books that I'm going to like that coming out next year. I'm not going out on a limb here.
Outstanding.
But there's a better than average chance that I'll like these three books. The first is by Mark Lehner, Leyner. Remember that name, anyone?
I do not.
No.
He wrote in the 90s a series of very weird, playful, absurdist satires with names like Et Tu, Babe, and I Smell Esther Williams. That was a collection of short stories. And My Cousin, My Gastroenterologist. Very funny books, but weird for the sake of weird in the Mo Sizlak parlance. But something that a young Glenn Weldon just ate up with a big old spoon because they were playful and metafictional, and I have no idea if I'm going to like this book.
When
he's coming out with a new book called The Sugar-Frosted Nutsack, which argues that it's going to be pretty good. Could be pretty good.
What could possibly go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong? So I'm really looking forward to seeing if I still like that kind of thing.
Right?
Because I'm going to guess from the title he's still doing that kind of thing.
Sure.
Daniel O'Malley is a name of a debut novelist who's coming up with a book next month, January, called The Rook. It's a supernatural detective thriller about a woman who works for an agency, a secret covert agency, that protects Great Britain from supernatural threats. All right.
That doesn't sound at all like anything we've seen before.
Yeah. However, what this book is getting talked up about is its sense of humor. It's funny and witty. And if it is, and I think it could fill that notch of the Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell that was from a years back, which a book that I really loved, that had that some of that same humor, magic, fun. Finally, a book by Nathan Englander is coming out next February called...
That guy.
Called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, which is just a fantastic title. The story, the title story was in last week's New Yorker. And, you know, yes, Nathan is a pal of mine.
Name-dropper.
But,
I call him Nady.
He writes brilliant, searing short stories that have endings that wallop you in the chest and make you think, you know what, this is what fiction's for.
Great.
Creating this feeling in me as I close this book, as I end the story, this is what fiction's about. So
excellent.
I cannot wait for that.
Lots of literary predictions from Glenn Weldon,
fun.
Books of the Future. All right. Well, we hope that you will come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or at the blog at Monkey C, and share with us your predictions for 2012 or what you think of our predictions for 2012. We love it. And that brings us to our final part of the show, which is what's making us happy this week. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Devastating explosions. Have you seen this?
No.
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. I know. It's,
well,
yes, I know.
You know, it's nice at the end of the year to do a little callback to the first ever, I believe it was the first ever thing making Linda happy was her shout out from the Old Spice guy.
It was early.
Early on in the series, yeah. The fact that the Old Spice guy was like, Linda.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was.
Old Spice has come up with a website as a holiday gift to the public that is devastatingexplosions.com. If a lot of people have seen it. If you haven't seen it, it loads up, and then it is just a hand hovering over a big red button, and you just put your mouse anywhere on the screen, click the button, and then it cuts to footage of... And each
time it's a different scene from a different movie or something.
There's probably like five or six of them.
Oh, I didn't stay.
And
that
then
long.
Oh, I did. went several passes through all the different explosions. And as several of my coworkers will be able to testify, with each explosion, I sort of rocked back in my chair and just pumped out my fist and just started bouncing up and down. It's just awesome.
Devastating explosions.
I am the target audience for devastatingexplosions.com.
Really appeals to the reptilian forebrain, doesn't it?
It made me very happy this week.
That is excellent.
That's very funny.
I will have to check that out. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
The stage musical version of Once, which I mentioned the other week, has already announced its transfer to Broadway.
Yes, it has.
So, yes, that's good. Also, Venus in Fur, which is a comedy about sadism, written by the writer David Ives, who is super smart and super funny. So that is a good thing. And in a twofer, there has been casting news on the Les Mis movie musical, which you may not have known.
You and I are so predictable.
Seriously, I know. You may not even have known that this was happening, but trust me, there is a subset of the population that does. When that subset of the population already knew that Hugh Jackman is going to be playing Jean Valjean, Russell Crowe is playing Javert, and Anne Hathaway has been cast as whatever her name is. Now it turns out that they're talking to Aaron Tveit, who was on Broadway in Next to Normal, who I loved because he was very pretty.
Yes.
And also really terrific. He's a terrific performer. So he's...
I don't like how you snuck that in there.
I kind of did, yeah. So he's...
Also good.
he's being talked about... I think he's in negotiations now for the character of Enjolras, who's the one who sings... Do you hear the people
it's
sing?
All and, it's all French to me.
And get this, get this, Sacha Baron Cohen as Thénardier.
Well, you know, he's in Hugo. He's quite an interesting presence in Hugo.
Yes.
So
he was also in Sweeney Todd.
Yeah. I think he's definitely trying to do some different stuff. And I actually thought he was, as a physical presence, very effective and very right in that part. And I believe also going to be playing Freddie Mercury.
Which is perfect casting.
Appearance-wise,
right?
you can't argue. All right. Thank you, Trey Graham. Casting from the world of the theater.
Mm.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
The main reason I'm so sanguine about the state of comedy podcasts is that just this last weekend, I discovered a brand new one.
Again?
Really like. And thank you. Thank you, Mike Kadziff. On paper, it's no different from any of the others that I listen to. It's L.A. comedian talking to other L.A. comedians about L.A. comedy. But it's great. It's called You Made It Weird. It's hosted by Pete Holmes, who's a comedian who's been around for a while.
No relation
to Linda. No relation to Dave. No relation to Sherlock. Uh-huh. He is the voice of the E-Trade baby, but don't hold that against the poor man. No.
I've seen him on Twitter. He's really funny.
But here's the reason that it works. And, you know, Nathan Rabin reviewed this podcast last week for the AV Club. And we haven't talked about Nathan Rabin in like a week. So why don't we dust him off? He nailed it. This guy has a combination of affability, like he's a really genial presence, and sincere curiosity. And that's something that a lot of the other podcasts may or may not have. I mean, you can tell when somebody is waiting for the other person to stop talking so he can do a bit, and right. when he actually wants to find out the answer uh-huh. to the question that he's asking. So it's called You Made It Weird, Pete Holmes. Check it out.
Comedy podcasts are your Clem Snide.
Yeah, pretty much.
Your Zaxxon machine.
You're absolutely right.
Here's what's making me happy this week. Back years ago, when I was but a girl, I used to read Premiere Magazine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I know where you're going.
And in Premiere Magazine was a columnist I very, very much adored, who went by the name of Libby Gelman-Waxner.
Yes, indeed.
Now, Libby Gelman-Waxner was a sort of, what would you say, an upscale married lady, you know, talked about the husband and the children.
She's meant to be a Scarsdale housewife sort of thing, right?
And she was actually the pen name and a character adopted by Paul Rudnick, who is a very funny writer who wrote, among other things, In and Out, which Kevin Kline mm-hmm. was in, and mm-hmm. Jeffrey. Stephen Weber was in. A very fine writer and very funny. And Libby appeared in Premiere Magazine for years, and I have Libby's book, which is like her column called If You Ask Me. This week, when I fired up Entertainment Weekly on my Kindle Fire, much to my surprise, right there in Entertainment Weekly was If You Ask Me by Libby Gelman-Waxner. They've brought it back to life. And there is probably not a column in the world that I could have been any happier to see return to my mm-hmm. life. And I have to read you a little bit of Libby from this week talking about Twilight. Because, of course, Libby has missed Twilight, and it's wrong. Everything in the Twilight films is always gorgeous and slow and agonizing. And when Kristen has a baby, she's shot in such tight close-up that she appears to be giving birth with her overbite. Personally, I worship Kristen's overbite because I can always sense the presence of a special assistant just off camera who's been hired to smile encouragingly at Kristen and to gently murmur the phrase, "Close your mouth." Robert is beyond squeal-worthy, even if the makeup people have never really nailed the vampire paleface thing, so Kristen seems to be marrying into a clan of greasy mimes. And, of course, I adore Taylor Lautner as Jacob the Hunky Werewolf, because when he learns that Kristen's pregnant, it takes him a long moment of deep thinking before he turns to Robert and yelps, "You did this!" And as a special bonus, there's even a new character named Renesmee, because what girl doesn't yearn to sound like a new prescription drug for acid reflux?
Nice.
I have missed Libby even more than I thought I had before I saw Libby writing again. It was a complete surprise to me that this column, gone many years, would suddenly reappear in a magazine that I already read.
Nice. Does that mean that we're not going to be treated to the writings of Stephen King doing an Andy Rooney bit every week?
I don't know that that's been a trade-off. Mm.
I found a new band, Wilco.
That's right.
Here's my mixtape for the year.
As an adjunct, I would like to give a shout-out to a Shouts and Murmurs column written by one Paul Rudnick in this past week, in which he reimagined or simply expanded the Kinsey scale to run from 1 to something like 13 or 15. its wrongness is great and terrible to behold.
Paul Rudnick, very, very talented, could not be happier to see Libby again. I let out a little squeal in my apartment. It was incredibly exciting. Just made me so happy. So that is what truly and honestly made me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn Weldon at GH Weldon, that's WELDON. You can follow our esteemed producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band Hello Come In provides our in and out music. You are tapping your foot to it right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here for our second to last show of the year.
Wouldn't miss it.
And thanks to all of you for being here, and we will be back next week for our last show of 2011.